KSL at Night was recorded and produced this afternoon. KSL at Night. Some of Utah's top political specialists join a roundtable on the day's biggest stories. KSL is at 102.7 FM and on every smart speaker when you say play KSL News Radio.
Good evening and welcome to KSL at Night. You're here with me this evening, Leah Murray. I am KSL's resident political science professor from Weber State University. And I'm alongside my good friend Greg Skordas, who is KSL's own legal analyst. How you doing, Greg?
I'm doing great. And I'm really excited about this show tonight. We've got a lot of segments that I think are really interesting. Just prepping for the show has been kind of fun.
Yeah, and I want to start with one of the things I think has been very interesting development over the last couple of years. And that is the role of diversity, equity, and inclusion in education. So we're going to start with campuses, which is what I know best and I'm very aware of what's happening on at least Weber State's campus. And then in our next segment, Greg, we'll stay with this topic and have a conversation about what it looks like in K-12 environments.
So Leah, let me just ask you this. I know that DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion have just been at the forefront of a lot of conversations lately, especially with our legislature taking that on right out of the get-go when the latest legislative session started. But just remind our listeners what we're talking about as it relates to higher education, and then we'll break it down for the next segment.
Yeah, K-12. So what I would tell listeners is we've been talking about this for a minute. For a couple of years now, we've been talking about it.
Right.
So if you've missed out on any of those shows, you can always go back and listen to what we've been talking about on kslpodcast.com and basically anywhere that you download your podcast, whatever app that you use, just look up KSL at Night. And I imagine maybe, Greg, if you also search DEI, right, you might pull up some of the conversations that we have had. So basically, diversity, equity, and inclusion has been an effort in education. And I've talked about this a number of times. You'd probably have remembered this as well. 30 years ago, I took a diversity course. Most of us who went to college, I mean, like decades we're talking about, took a class where the universities tried to expose students to a broader horizon of understanding, right? So maybe, you know, I remember taking like an anthropology class in undergraduate, right? That I was really not interested in anthropology, but I was required to do that. So the universities have like general education. They're trying to get their students to be well-rounded. They want them to see all sorts of things, learn all sorts of things. And diversity is one of them.
I'll be honest. This must have started in the 80s or 90s because it's not something that I took. It really isn't.
Yeah.
This DEI, the whole concept, I've just been wondering, what is it? How does it work in education? And you know, maybe we'll get into this later. How does it work in the broader picture of business and whatnot?
Yeah. So basically what happens is starts, at least in my experience, with taking a diversity class. And then in the last couple of decades, there's been kind of a move towards maybe that's not enough. And maybe what we need are centers on campus. So let's be clear. At Weber State University, I want to say there's less than 2% of our students are Black.
Right.
Right. And so you kind of go, that can feel very lonely. Does that make sense? Like you're not a lot of people who look like you on campus. That can be kind of lonely. And so then DEI moved into making sure, right, that there were spaces for students or work for students that helped them feel welcomed on campus. One of the words that we use in higher ed a lot.
Like a Black Students Union.
Black Student Union, could be a Hispanic multicultural center, right? Like it could be centers for students. It could be other things you might think about are scholarships, right? So we might say 80% of our students are white and we really feel like we should have more reflective of our community, right? You know, and where Weber State lives, there's quite a bit more Hispanic people than 20%, right? So you want to be like, we want our student population to look more like the community that we actually live in. And to be able to make that happen, maybe we need some scholarships to bring those students to campus. Does that make sense, Greg? So like DEI, for me, the way I learned it was it's curriculum, right? You're learning something.
Right.
But it also is in the programming, right? So it's basically, are there spaces on campus where students can feel welcome? We also see it in scholarships. Does that make sense? So you're like, one of the conversations I think you and I had was when they ended DEI, there is a scholarship at the University of Utah that is for Indigenous people in the state. And given the new rules, they can't give out that scholarship anymore, right? Because it's a scholarship based on someone's personal identity characteristic, which is their race. So the campuses are dealing with trying to make their space more welcoming to more students that look diverse, right? And that has kind of been across a lot of missions, if you will, in the different departments.
So let's talk about your school. Just bring it home. What's going on at the higher education?
Yeah. So actually, this is what I wanted to talk about. And the answer kind of is, I don't know. So today I was in a meeting and we were discussing having a candidate event in the fall that was for women candidates, right? So you want to be like, we want to promote the fact that there are women running for office in the state of Utah. And someone in the meeting said to me, can Weber State even host that? So if you are having an event that's just for women, which is a personal identity characteristic, are you allowed to host it? And honestly, Greg, my answer was, yeah, I don't know. Right. So I said, I guess we'll host it. And if I get in trouble, then we'll deal with the fallout afterward. So when you're asking me, like, what are the answers, right? Like, what is happening on our campuses? I actually am not sure. So this is what I wanted to do in this segment. And then maybe pick your brain as a legal analyst to see what things are happening. So let me give you a couple of points of reference.
Okay.
In Texas, there was a DEI ban. Not the same. I want to be clear. Utah's does look different from the Texas version or the Florida version. Our campuses are required to get rid of DEI in a number of places.
In their curriculum.
No. So our Utah's basically said faculty are left alone, student center, right? Like being nice to students is
okay.
But it can't be in training. Does that make sense? And
right.
It can't be like in hiring practices.
Okay.
And then like I talked about the scholarships, which we've discussed before, it's going to hit there as well. But in Texas and in Florida, it's like across the board, boom, like you cannot do DEI anymore at all. So the University of Texas at Austin, like this week, announced it's closing its division of campus and community engagement and fired everybody. So everyone who had been working in a DEI related role at UT Austin has lost their job this week. That's about 60 people on that campus. Over in Florida, the University of Florida eliminated all diversity, equity, and inclusion positions. They closed their office of the chief diversity officer. They stopped any contracts. So imagine external vendor comes into a campus and goes, right, you're going to do this work, and then you have to do some DEI language in that contract. And the University of Florida has stopped all of those. And all of the $5 million in funds annually that had been appropriated for DEI is now in a faculty recruitment fund.
So last night,
yeah, go.
Mara and I talked about just this broad poll that was done of Americans and their feelings about certain things. And one of the things that surprised me, and this might kind of go with what you're talking about, is that most Americans think that the country right now is too politically correct. Is that maybe part of the reason for the pushback for DEI? I know that's a little bit tangential, but I'm trying to think why. Because I've had some people call me and go, why do we care about DEI? What's the downside to it?
So I think the answer is, I like how you're maybe political correct is a proxy.
Right.
I think the word woke sometimes is a proxy. I want to say that historically, like people who study the history of education, which for the record, everyone is not me, right? So I'm now wandering into pieces I've read, but not necessarily my area of expertise. Basically, since the 1950s, conservatives have felt that campuses are mean to conservatives, that colleges, college towns are kind of bastions of liberal thinking and liberalism. And if you're really upset about it, what you think is it's indoctrination, right? So if that people go Syracuse University, where I went and I took that diversity course, what I was indoctrinated into some kind of belief system. So that's part of it. Does that make sense, Greg?
Sure.
I think it's like decades long conversation about what this work looks like. But let's just stay with this conversation, Greg, after the break, and we'll have a talk about
how. Because I have a lot more questions.
Yeah, and let's get into it in our next segment. Stay with us.
KSL at night.
Welcome back to KSL at Night. I'm Greg Skordas alongside Leah Murray, and we are continuing our conversation on DEI. And part of that, Leah, is because I have more questions after the first segment than I did before, and I appreciate you answering them. Part of me still wants to know why we're doing this, but before we get there, I want to talk about how DEI relates to our younger students, the K-12, and you've indicated that it's a different conversation when we deal with that.
Yeah, it's a really different conversation because when it comes to state legislatures, where a lot of this is happening, where the laws are, right, making decisions about DEI on campuses, when it comes to K-12, they're the boss. So with higher ed, courts have ruled that faculty have the right to make decisions about their curriculum.
Okay.
So there's more defense for a faculty member than there is for a third grade teacher. So we've had on this show during the legislature, legislators who are like, we're going to make decisions about what people are allowed to talk about in class, right? And I think you and I have interviewed legislators as those bills were running through.
Right.
So the thing is, when we talk about K-12, when the legislature says it, the teachers do it. Does that make sense? Like, it's a much
because
more...
Because they don't have a choice. It's
they
the
really
law.
Don't have a choice. It becomes a law. So what's interesting is 75% of our nation's children live in states where this became a political issue. Utah's on a list with Texas, Tennessee, and Florida. 33% of our students living in states like Utah, where they made legislation to restrict conversations and curriculum you can have that are related to race, sex, and gender.
And some of that occurred just recently.
Just this year.
This is this year.
This is data from the Washington Post where they were tracking thousands of bills across the country and what was going on in K-12. So this is K-12 listeners. We're not talking about higher ed anymore. 29% of students live in states where they were expanded. So to give you a very specific example of this, in Rhode Island, you cannot graduate high school unless you have passed an African heritage course. So Rhode Island said the other direction. Does that make sense? So Utah basically is like, you're not allowed to talk about this stuff. And Rhode Island said, actually, now you have to. And every student who graduates from our high schools is going to take a course in African heritage.
So like a lot of things that are going on in this country right now, it's a state by state decision. The legislature will decide in individual states what level and to what extent DEI will be taught in the public schools.
Yeah. And a little bit, Greg, I think it adds to the divisiveness in our country. So red states are telling their children what the world looks like, which is very different from blue states. And I kind of want to like just talk about this a little bit, the history of it. Most states, blue states started. So in the early 2010s, they start expanding curricula to include voices of historically marginalized students. They will tell you and they will argue that they are creating conditions where all students feel welcome. There is a response after COVID. So I don't know. I don't think you had kids at home, but in COVID, I had two children at home. And so I was Google Classrooming and canvassing. And I was like basically became a high school and elementary school student again. And I was really good at it for my second time. So I'm working with my kids. But you're very aware as a parent what they're learning when they're learning their stuff in your kitchen. As a result, and we actually heard legislators say this on the show, parents started calling their legislators and going, oh, my gosh, my kid is learning this. I wasn't really paying attention before, but now I know. So in 2021, we see a rise in restrictive bills around race, sex, and gender. So it's the blue states that move first. Does that make sense, Greg? And there's kind of like a flurry of activity after the George Floyd murders, right? So they're responding to that saying, oh my goodness, everyone needs to learn more. And then red states, we see the activity happening after COVID, where Republicans, and they argue, they're restricting indoctrination. They believe that the education system is indoctrinating students to believe certain things about race, gender, and sexual identity. And parents became super aware of it during COVID, started calling legislators and demanding action. And the answer really is, Greg, is like when you call your legislator, they're going to make a bill. Right? Do you know what I mean? Like what legislators do is they make law. So along the K-12, what we really have is, and this is what I think is interesting, again, not my area of expertise, but I was reading a piece by someone who's an expert in the history of education. There's always been controversy about curriculum, Greg. There's always been a debate about what this should look like. It's always been state to state to state because it's one of the ones in the Constitution that's kind of protected for states to do. So when we talk about things like common curriculum, right, like that, so everyone will remember you're nodding. Like this is, we've been having these fights forever. But really, it's not been as aggressive around rules, right? So blue state Democrats are telling kids and teachers what they can talk about in their states. Republican and red states are telling their kids, and really it's not being left to school boards or local districts anymore to make the decision.
So, and I'm looking at this chart, and you started the conversation with this, that sort of breaks down the country in terms of education legislation related to race, gender, and sex. And Utah, like you said, is one of four states who are on the very furthest part of the chart in terms of more restrictions. Utah, along with Tennessee, Florida, and Texas. We talked about Florida and Texas as it relates to higher education, but as it relates to K-12, Utah is one of the most restrictive states in the country, or at least.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's right there.
I don't know if you remember, and I beg your pardon, listeners, I can't remember. So, you know, go find us on the podcast and find this segment and listen to it. I can't remember which legislator, because we spoke to so many legislators during the session, but we spoke to someone who basically said, these people are employees. I don't know if you remember this, Greg. And
yes.
So he was like, in third grade, you do not need to have a flag on your wall, right, that has anything to do with some group that you are a member of. Do you remember that conversation?
Yes, right?
And I beg your pardon for I'm just blanking on who we were talking about it with. So basically the argument here is we are telling, and much more restrictive based on my memory, K-6, right? When you get into the secondary, it opens up a little bit more, right? The answer is those teachers, those kids are a little bit more mature. Maybe we can have harder conversations, but elementary school, there's kind of a lockdown what they are allowed to talk about.
So as we get into junior high and high school, as I recall, we started talking about American history. We started talking about, of all things, slavery, things like that. I mean, curriculum is going to change. If you're talking to those teachers, I know you're not the Board of Education's attorney, but if you're talking to teacher, I guess even your husband who teaches at the high school level.
Yeah.
And let's say he teaches history or something like that. I mean, you've got to say, you've got to have him relook at, and I hate to use a person in specifically, but any teacher, relook at their agenda, relook at what they're talking about, because a kid could go home and say,
yep,
hey, Mom, we learned about this today. And Mom or Dad could say, wait a minute, we're not supposed to be doing that anymore.
Yeah, no, exactly. And Paul teaches, my husband teaches AP U.S. history,
right,
and regular U.S. history and AP government and regular government. And he teaches about Emmett Till, who is a young man who was killed in advance of the civil rights movement. And I would argue is one of the catalysts for that movement. And he, when these bills ran through, he was like, can I still talk about Emmett Till? And then I could see him. He goes, I'm still going to talk about it. Right? Like, he was like, I am going to teach this material that is stuff that I think
but
our
he,
kids
but he
should
could
know.
Very well get called out on
but
that.
But he could get called out on it. And one of the things he did say, which I thought was interesting, was he's like, the kids might go home and tell their parents stuff and they might not even be right. Right? Because,
right,
you know, the kids are not always listening to everything that gets taught. Right? I watch him struggle with. Now, to be clear, with high school and with elementary school, at least with my husband, all of his lessons are totally available. And I'm got kids, I'm a parent, I can see every lesson my children do, right? I hop in as a parent observer in Canvas and I can see everything. So Paul's basically like, I'm telling every parent everything I'm saying, they can always see it. Does that make sense? Like,
yes.
So he feels like because he's transparent, maybe there is some protection, but absolutely he's been thinking about it this year.
And I think that part of the legislation, I don't remember if this part of it passed, required that teachers do publish their curriculum, do make that part of their announcement at the beginning of the year, or at least
yeah,
beginning of the semester, saying, here's what we're going to teach and here's how we're going to teach it, so that I guess parents can go online and look at it and say, wait a minute, this is in line or maybe this is not in line with what our current legislation is,
yeah,
in the state of Utah.
And by the way, I don't have a huge issue with this. All of my syllabi are public. I put them on a website, right? And Paul, like I said, he has all of his stuff is in Canvas. His worry is some of the restrictions. For example, if he shows up one day and half the kids are out on a field trip, he might adjust a lesson plan on the fly.
Sure.
Right? And so then his concern is if the rule says the lesson plans have to be laid out in August for the next 180 days, right? Like he might not actually be able to deliver on that because world intervenes, right? Other circumstances intervene.
Yeah, interesting. Well, thanks for breaking that down. I mean, you helped me a lot, and I hope our listeners appreciate that. Well, that was Leah Murray helping us understand DEI from both the K-12 and higher education perspective. Really interesting. We'll see how that goes, and maybe Utah is going to rebound a little bit, or maybe that's just the way we are. When we come back after the break, we're going to talk about this bizarre flurry of hit and runs we've been seeing in Salt Lake County. We now have one in Summit County. It appears to be the same suspect. Stay with us.
KSL at night.
And welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, alongside my good friend Greg Skordas, and we're talking about all the interesting things, including breaking news. Now,
yes,
Greg, I am on the KSL news text line. So this morning at like 7:15 a.m., I'm going to say, that sounds really precise, so let's just go with it, it was 7:15 a.m. I heard about this next segment we're going to talk about is that this person was doing some intentional hit and runs in Salt Lake County and then just got caught because he was in Summit County. So here's what I'm going to tell y'all. If you are dying that in the morning you get a text from KSL, so you are up to speed on everything that is happening, just like I am right now. Staying in the snow is easy. Just text the word breaking, B-R-E-A-K-I-N-G, not breaking like breaking to stop your car, but right. Breaking like breaking news. Text that word to 57500. And like me in the morning, or I think all throughout the day, you will get texts telling you what is going on.
That's interesting.
Dude, are you on that text line?
I am now. You just helped me set it up. So yeah, that's great. 57500, text the word breaking.
All right. So Greg, what I got texted today was this 26-year-old man was accused of intentionally hitting at least 6 women in Salt Lake County and has just been named in Summit County. I'm not sure I'm going to pronounce his name correctly. Is it Ann Pham?
Yes, Ann Pham.
Ann Pham, excuse me. Go ahead.
He's been charged in Salt Lake County with 12 counts. And you said exactly right. 6 women were hit. And so for each count, he's charged with an attempted murder and a hit and run. So each of those events resulted in
two charges.
So 6 victims, 12 counts. The attempted murder charge, Leah, carries a term of imprisonment of up to life in prison and a minimum of 5 years. It's 5 to life, where murder itself is a 25 to life. Attempted murder is 5 to life. And the hit and run is also a felony. It carries a prison term of up to 5 years. So these are serious charges, and they all seem to be sort of coalescing around the same individual. And he's in jail now. And since he's been in jail, there have been at least 3 other incidents or people going, hey, wait a minute, we had an incident like that in our city as well. We know that the Salt Lake County case involves Sandy and Salt Lake City, and that there were probably 4 or 5 of them just in Salt Lake City alone, but there was another one in Sandy. And like you said, we learned today that Summit County has him as a suspect in a case up there as well.
All right, so there's a lot to unpack there. So let me ask you a question. So we've got 6 definite, 7 for Summit. And each of them are going to be 2. So is that like 6 times 5 plus 6 times, do you know what I mean? Like the 5 for the hit and run plus, right? Like, does that mean he could be in jail forever?
Well, I mean, he's got a life sentence on each one as it starts with. So yes, but I mean, if he's facing 7, 8, he's probably going to have, I think they're up to about 9 counts now where there would be an attempted homicide, which is a 5 to life, and a hit and run, which is up to 5 years in prison. So yeah, the charges could be astronomical. The thing that concerns me, and I don't know that we're going to get into this too much, is that the crimes are so bizarre. Every once in a while you see a course of conduct that's just so bizarre that you have to wonder about the mental state of the individual.
All right, so tell us about that, because it's not, I feel like you'd expect with a hit and run, it's like someone was looking at their phone, hit somebody,
exactly,
freaks out, and
right,
they leave.
Right.
But this is actually a story of malice and intent.
Right. No, these are directed car attacks at people. Yeah, I've done a lot of hit and runs, mostly involving people.
Wait. You haven't done a lot of hit and runs.
I represent a lot
right?
of people charged with hit and run. And often it's people who are not paying attention, maybe intoxicated, leave the scene thinking they might get away with it. And of course, it never happens because everybody leaves a license plate or bracket or something, you know, on the side of the road. They're just something that police can find, or, you know, they go home and they're spouse is going, what's going on here? You got some clothing on the front of your car. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, they it's not something you get away with. Although this person did get away with it for some period of time. However, he's now been charged. Yeah, it's a serious crime. It's something that occurs more than you think. And these, I think the point of your question was, it's not just a hit and run where you have, that's a crime. It's a serious crime. But it's an attempted murder. So the district attorney, and he's obviously presumed innocent, and I want to maintain that. But the district attorney's office in Salt Lake County and perhaps in Summit County feel like these were targeted attacks, mostly at women, and that his intent was to cause them harm. I mean, when you're coming after somebody with a car, it's not to scare them or to hurt them like you would with a bat or something like that. I mean, it's almost certain to cause their death. So if you get involved in something like that, it makes sense. if they believe that his conduct was intentional. And if you look at these videos, I've seen one. It's horrific.
Yeah.
It looks like a very directed attack.
Right. I was going to read, so I'm just going to read right from the KSLTV.com story. They have a person talking about they've seen it. This girl was running across the street and he was chasing after her.
Right.
And I'm like, he's going to get her. He's going to hit her. And he did. He hit her. She flew up in the air. So that's a quote from Christy DeMarco. So the answer is, people are watching him behave this way, right? So the reason they can catch him, Greg, is because, you know, people know it's his car. It's like this white car that he's got.
Right.
And they see him targeting pedestrians. What do you think it says that most of them are women?
It makes me think, and I'm just playing armchair quarterback here. It makes me think that he's got some anger issues, something going on that he wants to hurt women because they are targeted. I think there was one that involved a couple, but it seems like he's targeted. He's got some real rage and hate. That's why I think there's some mental health issues going on here. They may not excuse his conduct. I mean, certainly not going to excuse it very much because it's such a directed conduct. But to me, it seems like he's got somebody that's got some
issues.
Can
I ask you a question? Does
Sure.
that become a hate crime? So if it feels like he's targeting women, is that
a protected class? That's interesting.
Yeah,
you know,
I'm just kind of wondering.
Could you call that a
right.
hate crime? I mean, and I don't know what that would do when he's already facing 5 to life in prison. You know, you can't
make him
make
stay
it
in
much
jail
worse
longer.
Than that, right?
Okay, I gotcha.
But that's a great question. You're prodding at my legal expertise here. Could it be? Yeah, I think it probably could be.
All right, so let's talk about the fact that we've got a number of different law enforcement jurisdictions, right? So you said Sandy. I was saying Salt Lake County, Salt Lake City. There's Park City over in Summit County.
Right.
It's part of the reason why it takes a minute, because some of these go back to like last August when you look at the list, is because he's in all these different districts. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and that's odd. I think a lot of people are concerned about that because perhaps had law enforcement been more aggressive at the beginning after the first one or two or three, there wouldn't have been 7 or 8 or 9. But it's such a bizarre crime. It's not like, you know, persons are targeting credit unions and robbing credit unions or scamming people by a certain method on the phone. This is a hit and run. You just don't think of a serial hit and runner. I mean, it's so bizarre that I know people are concerned with law enforcement for not getting on this much earlier, but just from the law enforcement perspective, just having worked with them and worked as a prosecutor, it's such a bizarre crime that you don't think of it as somebody that's targeting people. And it probably took, like you say, 5 or 6 of them before people started thinking, hey, there's a person here who's really doing some horrible things. And it seems to be much worse than just an accident or inattentive driver or somebody who's texting, you know, as he approaches an intersection.
Right. So the answer is we totally wouldn't think this is the thing.
Right.
Right. So we're not tracking it. That's interesting. So.
And I guess I'm not defending police because it did take a long time. But I think to me, it's understandable that they didn't coordinate this the way, because I've worked with Metro police units, you know, that you have different agencies and they're getting together and they're working on gangs or they're working on drug interdiction or doing that kind of a thing. They're working together. But for traffic, we don't think of a unified police agency that's coordinating their efforts to get, you know, certain type of traffic. You know, let's get the speeders. You know what I mean? It's just not the kind of thing you do. So in that respect, it seems like it took longer than it maybe could have, probably should have to get this man hooked up. But and if he's the one that did it, I mean, we'll see. But it's just a bizarre course of conduct.
All right. Next up on KSL at Night, let's take a cold plunge. After the break, we'll have KSL's very own Jessica Lowell talk about a special story she's been working on for General Conference Weekend.
KSL at Night. KSL at Night.
You're back with us on KSL at Night alongside Leah Murray. I'm your host, Greg Skordis. And Leah, this weekend is the 194th annual General Conference of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And as usual, KSL News Radio will be broadcasting special content that our reporters and producers have been working on during breaks in the conference. And last night, we had Debbie Dujanovic on our show. She's doing a segment on bipolar disorder and an individual who, specifically involving an individual who took his life on January of this year at the Salt Lake International Airport, and just sort of how that all works out. It was a really fascinating story that she is doing on that particular individual, but more broadly on the disorder in general. Tonight we have with us Jessica Lowell, who's going to talk to us about something really interesting. I don't know if you've ever done this, Leah, but it's called cold plunging, which is just exactly what it sounds like.
I've done like the polar bear challenge.
Oh, you have?
Do you know what I mean? Like when I was like a Girl Scout, you run into the water in the freezing cold water.
And did you come out a better person?
Clearly.
Well, there are some physical and mental benefits to this that a lot of us hadn't thought about. And so we're going to be talking to Jessica Lowell about that. Let's talk to her now. Jessica, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Greg. Hi, Leah.
And Jessica, by the way, is the executive producer for Jeff Kaplan's Afternoon News. And Jessica, what got you interested or decided to look into cold plunging?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it has to do with Utah's long cold winters here. I think last year was particularly hard on a lot of people, and I think there are a lot of people who have seasonal depression. And I think I was looking into ways of how, you know, people can embrace the winters. And a friend had mentioned to me that he liked to take cold showers, and it really was a hard reset for him. And then, I don't know, as cold plunges have just become more popular and they started popping up on my feed, I was really interested in looking at them and seeing if there were any actual benefits of doing cold plunges for your mental health.
So I'm going to tell you what, Jessica, I don't know what feed, like your For You feed is very different than mine, because I'm going to tell you, I've never heard of this until we're talking about it. So I do not have cold plunging all over my feed.
You said you did it.
I need to, as a Girl Scout, like 40 years ago, I don't think that's what she's talking about. So I clearly need you to curate my content. But here's the thing, when we think about it politically, this last session, so Senator Kurt Bramble ran a bill, SB 106, that would prohibit the Department of Health and Human Services from regulating public cold baths, or I guess to make them legal. So clearly he's on the same feed you are, Jessica.
Why would they have ever been illegal?
Right. So can you talk to us about what Senator Bramble was doing? Yeah. And what Greg is saying, why is it illegal? You know, why is the legislature getting involved?
Why did we have to ask that question?
It's not it's not necessarily that it's illegal. It's just that it was such a new thing. And there were these companies that were starting to open that offered cold plunge experiences. So you could pay and get in a cold tub. And these companies kind of had no parameters with the health department. So they were being treated like they were pools. And, you know, pools are supposed to be a certain amount of warmth because, you know, it can be risky as a small child to get into a freezing cold pool, or if you have health conditions, to get into a freezing cold body of water. And so they were trying to regulate them like, oh, they have to be at least 60 degrees and the water has to be changed every time someone new gets in. And they had all these special parameters for them. They didn't have all these special parameters for them. They were just being regulated like pools. And so as these companies were opening up, they were like, well, we can't work as a cold tub experience place because there's no rules around it, and we're being treated like pools, and some of them are counterintuitive because, you know, we want our water to be as cold as possible, and they're telling us they have to be a certain level of warmth. So what Kurt Bramble did was he just outlined this regulation that there won't be regulations kind of for these cold plunge experiences so that they can actually function as they want to.
How did we miss that one, Leah? The cold plunge bill.
Because we talked about all the legislation. Social media feed as
right,
Jessica.
But you can now pay money to jump into a cold bath. So there have to be some benefits to this, Jessica. And talk to us about the health benefits.
Yeah, so I talked to a health expert, a University of Utah health athletic trainer, about some of the physical and mental benefits that I was hearing about when I was talking to people. And, you know, there's not a lot of research into this yet. It's kind of a new phenomenon, and people are doing it for all sorts of different reasons. And there's a lot of anecdotal studies into it, but not a whole lot of, you know, studies with consistent parameters. So, but really what he told me is that, you know, we've been icing injuries forever. You know, you get a sore ankle and you put an ice pack on it. And this is kind of a similar thing of, you know, athletes, you've seen it in movies, I'm sure, where an athlete has a really hard workout, a football player, the wrestler or whatever, and they get in an ice bath. So this has been a thing for a long time that athletes have been doing. And now more and more people are doing it for the physical benefits as well, where, they're getting into these cold tubs for just soreness or inflammation that they have. And then as far as the mental health benefits, you know, she says, we all know, we've all heard of like a cold shock. And she says that when this happens, you get an increase in adrenaline and serotonin. These are like happy hormones. And also it gives more opportunities for dopamine to bind. So all these happy hormones are being released all at once. And so you are just getting this big rush of happy hormones. And she says that some of those psychological changes can last for as long as 24 to 48 hours.
Jessica, I'm just going to ask you, have you ever done a cold plunge?
Yes, I did my first one while I was doing my conference special, and I got it all on tape.
Oh, good.
Oh, you recorded it. Okay, so pause. And you were super, super happy when you jumped in that freezing cold water?
I, you know, my fear hormones, I think. Okay. But I will say when I came out, I did feel like this giddiness and this euphoria, and I was just, you know, buzzing.
Yeah, because I'm with you totally on the physical, right? Like if you, I follow sports and always the athletes are hopping into some kind of bath of cold water, right? That totally makes sense. But the mental health, I can see that, though. There is no hot water in your shower, you are angry. Like, if you are taking a cold shower, I don't think you're happy.
Yeah, it's definitely not a cozy experience.
So tell us about your experience, Jessica. What did you do?
Yeah, so I went up to the Weber River in Oakley, and it was a freezing cold day in February. It was snowing, and I went with a woman who's been going every day for 2 years, and she was getting in on the anniversary of her 2 years getting in, and I got in myself with her for my first time ever, and I got into the river, and I think I lasted a little over a minute, and that's all I could stomach.
Wow.
And then I was like, I need to get out now.
A minute's a long time. And that river in February was probably at freezing temperature.
I'm questioning all of your life choices, Jessica, but I'm going to believe you that it was good for your health and then it was good for your mental health. Have you done it since?
No.
So you didn't go every day? Gotcha.
No, I think I now have this feeling whenever I think of getting into the cold water where I have that dread that I think a lot of other people feel where I'm like, there's no way somebody could convince me to get into cold water right now.
Jessica, tell us, like, because you're doing kind of, you're telling us what you're talking about. When does this special air? When our listeners, when should they be paying attention?
Yeah, so my special will air on Saturday, and it will air from 4 to 5 p.m.
That's really interesting. And so what even got you thinking about this? How did this even come up as a topic?
Yeah, I mean, I think I just was looking into potential mental health benefits during the summer. During the winter, and I just wanted to see if there were any kind of studies, any kind of research into things that people could do to deal with seasonal depression. I'm from Florida, so dealing with cold winters, cold, gloomy winters was new for me. And so I was curious about it. And then I found cold plunging and I jumped into this world where there were so many more benefits than people said that there were so many more benefits than I could have ever imagined.
Well, we'll look forward to your program Saturday at 4 p.m. Jessica, thank you for joining us.
Great. Thank you, guys.
And when we come back after the break, let's talk about elections.
KSL at Night was recorded and produced this afternoon. KSL at Night. Some of Utah's top political specialists join a roundtable on the day's biggest stories. KSL is at 102.7 FM and on every smart speaker when you say play KSL News Radio.
And welcome back to the second hour of KSL at Night, where we are talking about all the most interesting things. I'm Leah Murray alongside my good friend Greg Skordas. Here's the deal. If you're catching this and you're like, man, I want to hear everything they just said in the last hour and I've missed it, you can always find us on KSLpodcast.com. After our show's been aired, just look up KSL at Night and you can download it and listen to it. Go back and listen to it in more detail. Really, any app where you get your podcasts is where you can find us. Now, Greg, it's the next hour of our show, and I want to talk about elections because it's election year. It's a presidential election. And in that conversation, states really matter.
Sure.
Okay, so it's very different. I always tell my students, basically, people running for president run 50 different campaigns, right? 50 sure. different sets of contexts going on. It is not a national election. We do not have a national election. It is a national office that is elected through 50 state sets of rules. Okay.
Interesting way to look at it, but that's exactly right.
Yeah, right.
That's exactly right.
Florida, and I love talking about Florida, you know, Florida man.
We talk about Florida too much. There's just always something going on with Florida.
So much interesting stuff in Florida. Florida is a pretty important state in the presidential election. So I wonder what you think. I feel it's a pretty predictably red state. Some people still have it listed on a battleground list like it's a purple state. What is your take?
I think it's still a purple state. Do you recall it wasn't that long ago, maybe, well, a little while ago, 2000, when okay, that's not that long ago when you're my age, but Florida
Craig.
Was the state that decided, I think in a lot of respect, decided the election. So I still think of that year.
That was 24 years ago, Craig.
I know, but Al Gore and George W. Bush, they're running. If you recall, that year, Gore wins the popular vote, but Bush wins the election because he gets the electoral vote. And we were all focused on Florida at the very end. And remember the term that none of us had ever heard before, hanging chads?
Yeah.
Remember? And we were just all hung up over Florida. So at least at that time, it was a close call state. That's how I remember it.
I love this. First of all, our producer was not alive when that happened.
Okay, well.
So a little bit.
So she learned something today.
Yep. All right. So
And they have a very controversial governor.
Well, I don't know that he's controversial for them. And
sure.
They voted for Trump pretty handily. And they voted for him, their governor, when he said, I'm a good friend of Trump. Does
right,
that make sense?
Right,
twice.
Right.
So let's talk about Florida. So the thing is, I think it's going to vote Republican. And I just think that's a thing. You think
okay.
it's purple because a quarter of a century ago, it was purple. So, you know, listeners, you could pick which team you want to go with, Greg or with me. But Greg might be right, and here's why. Today, the Supreme Court in Florida, so not the U.S. Supreme Court, Greg, but the Florida Supreme Court, ruled on two things having to do with abortion. Okay, so they ruled on a 6-week abortion ban. So they upheld the state's restrictions, right? So that means they've got their 6-week abortion. Like, I guess you can't have an abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy, which is a pretty strict version of abortion law, right?
Right.
Is that stricter
than
ours?
Yes.
Okay.
I think Utah's 12 right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, like, Florida's really, really strict on their abortion law. And then at the same time, the Florida Supreme Court okayed ballot language for an amendment to the state constitution so that voters in November could choose whether to protect abortion access. So they're basically like, here, the 6 week is in, but if you don't like it here, you can vote on it in November. So I feel like, you know what I mean? Like, Florida's a pretty red state, but abortion's been a hot topic.
It is nationally.
Yeah.
And Florida, that's a great example talk about a state like that, a red state, because we learn, even in the reddest of the red states, that there's still a huge, and this is another thing that we talked about last night when we talked about trends in the country and views about people in the country. One of the questions that they asked people was, do you feel that a person who seeks an abortion should be prosecuted criminally? And the answers were overwhelmingly Democrat and Republican. No, no, no. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, and I know that's a little bit of an extreme example, but it still shows that even Republicans, even conservatives are thinking, wait a minute, we have to put the brakes on this a little bit and not go so far as to criminalize it. I know we're not talking about that, but it gives you some idea that some people realize that the country is starting to drift a little bit too far in terms of abortion access.
Yeah. And what's interesting, last week I had a conversation with Taylor Morgan on this show, Greg, about the fact that a person won as a Democrat in a suburban seat in Alabama running on abortion rights.
Yeah.
So never in Alabama. My goodness. If Florida's red, Alabama is magenta, right? And I would argue Kansas voting to make abortion, right, constitutionally
right,
protected.
Right.
All across the board so far, when abortion has become an election issue, people show up and the Democrat wins the argument. So it's not been a winning issue for Republicans. So if I put on the ballot after I've said you can't have an abortion after 6 weeks, which is the strictest version of this possible, maybe, I might think. You
have a, besides an outright ban.
This is pretty close to an outright ban. Right. And then I'm going to say, now you can vote on it. Man, every Democrat in that state is going to run on that, and it's going to be a winner for most of them. The other thing on the ballot in Florida this fall, Greg, is recreational marijuana. Now, I'm just going to tell you what. I know who Jimmy Buffett is. I feel like he's dead now, but he hung out in the Florida Keys.
Eating Margaritavilles in the Florida Keys? Yeah, it's gotta be.
So I kind of feel like these people are probably somewhat friendly towards a recreational marijuana piece of legislation. And that too is a winner for Democrats, right? Because yes. I feel like younger people are more likely, like they are not interested in Biden. They are not interested in Trump. They do not want to check into this whole polarized world. But they might show up, man, for recreational marijuana. And while they're there, I imagine they might vote for Biden.
And reproductive rights. Right.
Right. Right. So I think abortion's going to mobilize a whole set of people, including a lot of women in the state of Florida. I think recreational marijuana is going to mobilize young people in the state of Florida. So you're bringing, and so this is why states and the presidential election is so fun. It's Trump and Biden. One would think Florida men would vote for Florida man Trump, right? Like all of them are from Florida. They're going to show up and vote for him. He's their guy. But you put on that Florida ballot a restrictive abortion access context,
right,
with making it possible for them to get an abortion, and you added recreational marijuana, that results probably in higher voter turnout. And in a Florida state, higher voter turnout makes it purple.
So we started this conversation with 2000 and you said you're out of touch. And now you've come around and agreed I'm saying, but for different reasons.
I didn't agree that what happened 24 years ago should be the reason we think what's happening today is happening.
But I mean, we don't change overnight. I mean, 24 years, that's a little bit of time. We think of Ron DeSantis,
Greg,
as being way out there, but that's not Florida. I mean, he's done a lot of talk about DEI. We talked about that earlier tonight. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the state at the forefront of that, if you recall. But then you get these issues like reproductive rights, recreational marijuana. Who would have ever thought Utah would have medicinal marijuana?
Oh, I know.
I mean,
right.
People asked me that years ago. And I said, there's no way. It's never, not going to happen in our lifetime. Baby steps. You know, we have medicinal marijuana. It's very restrictive. Who knows where we're going to be in the future here? Again, that could be a topic that we deal with in this state someday.
Yeah. No, and it's interesting. I love how you just talked about it. Like Ohio has marijuana, right? Like I just think some of our more Republican states, meaning they vote Republican presidentially,
right,
but you go down into the issue weeds a little bit and you find some differences, you
right.
know?
And those are issues that bring people
that
to
bring
the
people
ballot,
to the polls.
And they may be more left-leaning and they may be
right.
making Florida a little bit more purple this year than it's been in the past.
Yeah, and it makes it harder for campaign consultants to figure out what to talk about and what to say in these states.
I think what you'll see
is
more Republicans coming a little bit around on some of those issues to avoid that very problem.
Yeah, maybe, which would be super interesting.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. So next up on KSL at Night, let's stay with elections and let's stay with states. The Wall Street Journal has a new poll looking into 7 of the battleground states. Greg, Florida's not on that list. And
neither's Utah, I'll bet.
No, it is not. We'll break it down after the break.
KSL at Night.
You're with us again on KSL at Night alongside Leah Murray. I'm your host this evening, Greg Skordis. And Leah, let's stay on the topic of elections, the presidential election, and talk about a new Wall Street Journal poll that looks into 7 swing states. You have decided that Florida is not one of those swing states.
Greg Skordis, I have not decided. The voters for the last 25 years have decided, but go ahead.
24. Okay. So let's talk about 7 swing states. And because, I mean, let's face it, that's what usually ends up happening in this country. We have states that are like Utah. We're going to vote for Trump. Florida, who knows what they're going to go. And other states are going to go California, New York, probably going to go Democrat. We'll see. But there are 7 states that we look at.
So let's name the 7
sure.
so that everyone knows. And so everyone pay attention that none of these names are going to sound like Florida. Georgia, Arizona, Michigan, North Carolina, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. So these are the states that it will matter in November how they go. So when we're all watching, like on election night, paying attention, we will be watching how these states go. I love you, but no one will be watching Florida.
Right. Okay. And the good news for Trump, bad news for Biden, is Biden is not doing well in these states, in any of them except Wisconsin.
That's right. So he is only leading in Wisconsin. He's trailing in all of the other states.
Okay, there's a caveat, because a lot of the voters were asked, or at least there seems to be some notion that the trial that Trump is facing in April, if he's found guilty, could swing those numbers.
Yeah, so people are talking about if he is found guilty, then we're talking anywhere from 7 to 14 point drop in people wanting to vote for him.
Yeah.
So while he is just on trial, does that make sense? Like, it doesn't hurt him and maybe even helps him because maybe someone gives him money. But if he were to be found guilty of any of the number of charges that are pending against him, and Greg, do you remember what that number is? It's not 91 anymore because some of them got knocked down.
Yeah, they got some tossed. I don't remember. It's still a lot.
Yeah, but if he gets found guilty of any of those, he tanks. Does that make sense? Like,
sure.
I think part of the reason why Nikki Haley stayed in so long was she was kind of counting on having enough delegates in case that does happen between now and the Republican National Convention.
Let me follow up with that.
Yeah.
If he's acquitted of all, let's say, 75 counts, that's going to help his numbers.
I'm not sure that's true.
I think if a lot of people feel that this is a political prosecution, and knowing in America that it's hard to hit heads 75 times, you know what I mean? That they're, I'm just guessing, 75 counts. And he wins 75 out of 75. People have got to think this was a political prosecution. Right or wrong?
Right. But I think those people will have already decided how they feel.
Yeah.
Right? That 7 to 14 point drop is not Biden voters or independents. It would be the Republicans who probably don't really like Trump very much, but he's their guy because that's their party.
Right.
Like, that would be the final straw.
And independents who are not crazy about Biden because of his age or other things. Right. Right.
Right. So when we look at these, one, we're worried for Biden, if you worried for Biden, right? Like, we're worried he might lose. For the record, Biden's not worried. It's interesting. There was an article about his last campaign. This will be his last campaign. And he's feeling pretty confident. So I don't know what he knows.
What else does he say? But he's worried to death.
Insiders are saying he's not worried. But let's take a look at what we see inside of these polls. So if Taylor were on the show with us, Greg, he would say, we got to look in the crosstabs.
Yeah,
right? We got to drive down.
Look at the numbers.
Look at this data. So what we see are men are moving. So in these states, 46% of men voted for Biden in 2020. Now 37% of men are polling that they support him. So he loses
9%.
A number.
Yeah. That's a big drop. That's a big drop.
And this is it kind of begs the second question, which is that it's minority voters who are men. So Black and Latino men are drifting toward Trump, with Latino men actually outright liking Trump better. So they are polling, they like Trump better than they like Biden. So it's men who have moved, and it's like minority men. Does that make sense? Who have moved in Trump's favor?
Yeah, I don't understand that at all. I really don't. I mean, is there such a fear with Biden's age, or are there other factors going on here? Because it's hard to imagine Latino and Black men supporting Trump, given his agenda. I'll just be straight. Well, it's hard for me to understand that.
It's not hard for me to understand it, at least for Latino men. I mean, I think Hispanic population in this country is relatively conservative, right? And I think if you were someone who cared about, like, social issues, like, I don't know, abortion, the reason there's no longer abortion in this country is because of Trump, hands down, right? So I think that might matter. And that, to me, might explain why it's Latino men and not women. Right. Because I do think women move in a different direction around abortion than men generally do.
Right.
So that might make some sense. And I do think that former President Trump pulled on doing so many things for Black men in this country, so many things for Latino men in this country, that it's possible that's landing with some of them.
Even though none of it was true. I'm sorry.
All right. So let's talk about, in the last segment, we talked about Florida and I talked about young voters. Does that make sense? So young voters were a huge part of Biden's coalition. In fact, I would argue they were necessary for his election in 2020. And they are moving away from Biden. Not so much toward Trump, just kind of disaffected. Does that make sense? Drifting out of this election. But what's interesting is older people favored Trump in 2020, but in these polls, they're drifting toward Biden. So a little bit, I wonder if, like, the whole country's saying he's too old.
And old people are going, wait a minute.
Yeah. And all these, you know, members of the American Association of Retired Persons who have plenty of
time
on that Tuesday.
Be careful.
Who can show up to vote and will actually vote. Maybe it actually helps in his favor, which would be very interesting.
Yeah. And then we talk about third party options. When we talk about those, We're talking about Kennedy.
Yeah.
Good for Kennedy.
No, there's other people like Jill Stein in the Green Party is running.
But the name that I think that we would expect the most support for. Actually, I thought that third parties would take away from Biden, but it looks like they're pulling away from Trump.
Well, it depends.
I don't understand that.
Right. All right. So let's talk about that. So if the third party is on the ballot, what we have is a 15-point draw away from the major candidates. Does that make sense? So
right.
Third parties in our country's system basically operate as spoilers. Kennedy looks like he would draw as much as 15% in Nevada, 12% in Michigan, 7% in Pennsylvania. And it looks like he is a threat to Trump in those states. So Republicans' view of him are favorable, whereas Democrats actually are unfavorable. But when we add the other candidates, Jill Stein, Lars Mapstead, Cornel West, those people combined pull from Biden. So if it's a head-to-head like Kennedy, Biden, Trump, that hurts Trump. If it's a head-to-head, right? Like, you know what I mean?
Right.
I add all these other people, then Biden takes a hit.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting. You hear so many people, more than I've ever remember in my lifetime, saying, I can't vote for either of the major party candidates. And so these third party candidates could be an important part of this election more than they've ever been. We've never thought about them. I mean, who is that? Ross Perot.
1992.
You're so smart. And the country hasn't changed much since then.
I know you think that.
But, you know, he was a third party candidate, actually did fairly well, but not, you know, he didn't get some momentum for third party candidates. We just haven't seen that.
No. And so the thing that's interesting is it will totally depend on the state. So the state of Utah right now, this is the only state Kennedy's on the ballot. So our LG was like, come on in.
Yeah.
You could just be on the ballot. We're so happy for you. But so again, right, listed, we got names. Cornel West, Jill Stein, Mapstead. We've got Kennedy. It really depends on state rules and ballot access in those states, Greg, for those contexts. So I can poll.
But time's wasting for Kennedy if he's only on one state so far.
Yeah, he's got some work to
that's
do,
not,
right?
That doesn't look good.
But so the answer basically is the polling. I can just add all the names, but the ballot's going to be tighter. So we'll see how that looks in those states.
So you mentioned the third party candidates, and I'm not going to have you break them down, but how would they affect Biden adversely?
So if it's Cornel West, that's a left.
Okay.
Right. Does that make sense? If it's Jill Stein, that's environmentalist. So if you feel
right,
Biden is not good on climate change, Jill Stein is a choice for you. Right.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
Right.
Okay. The last takeaway, Wisconsin, he is winning. And the interesting thing about Wisconsin is those voters reported that the economy is doing well. They feel like they're doing well. And then they like Biden better. So the message in there, right, Greg, is if Biden can persuade people that actually things are going well economically, which I would argue they actually kind of are,
right.
Then that might be a path forward for his victory.
It's interesting. Yes, because Biden is pushing so hard. He's economic policies and where we are. And you look and you think, well, the stock market's at an all-time high. Unemployment's at a fairly almost all-time low. Things are pretty good. But a lot of young people, and they're a big part of the vote this year, can't afford homes because interest rates are high. That could change between now and the time of the election, too. I think Trump's concerned that the Fed might do that for political reasons. Of course, the Fed's apolitical as much as it could be, but they could very well have a drop in interest rates between now and then, which could affect the people's view on the economy. When we come back after the break, let's continue our discussion on elections, this time how it's intersecting with the markets.
KSL at Night.
And welcome back to KSL at Night. You're here with me, Leah Murray, alongside my good friend Greg Skordas, and we're chatting this hour about elections. And what we've learned is that this is where states really matter.
Yep.
But Greg was kind of going after in our last segment the markets a little bit, right?
Yeah, so it's the economy.
Right. So what we had learned, that was a 1992 quip. That was cute from Bill Clinton's campaign. It's the economy, stupid. So the answer basically here is it's all about states. But in Wisconsin.
How do you just know these years? How do you just pull them out of your head? Ross Perot, 92. Like, I didn't even give you a heads up on that. It's the economy, stupid, 92.
I am very,
I had to look up Florida Chads. I had to look that up as we were preparing.
Well, you are a criminal defense attorney. I'm a political scientist. So
okay. Right.
I don't know
there
anything about like
You're
five to
amazing.
Life or whatever. So,
right.
Okay. So when we talk about elections, sometimes people think it's some kind of national election. And what I was making the argument in the last two segments, it's really, it's about states and we got to look inside of the states. But when we talk about nationally, exactly what you just said, it's the economy, stupid. So Wisconsin is saying they're happy with the economy, and so they are happy with Biden. If the economy is doing well, generally the incumbent president wins. So desperately, what Trump is rooting for is for the country to kind of tank economically, or at least for everyone to think they are tanking economically, right? But let's talk very specifically about the market. So you brought up unemployment rates, you brought up inflation, you brought up the markets, right. But you also talked about housing.
Right.
And those are kind of measures.
Sure.
One of the things you talked about were markets. So if I were an investor, what I want to maybe decide is how I'm going to vote based on what we know about the market. So this one's for you, Greg. It goes back to 1933.
There you go.
You don't go back to 1933.
No, thank goodness.
But you go back near, adjacent, somewhere around?
No, the 50s.
All right. So back in 1933 until today, what we're looking at is the annual return for the S&P 500 index when we've got different situations with our presidents and our Congress. OK, so let me just lay out these numbers,
yeah,
Greg,
okay.
And then we can chit chat about them. So stocks do better. They do the best. The market does the best. So if your money is in stocks, the market does the best when you've got a Democratic president with a Republican Congress. So 15.7% annual return on your investment with a Biden, basically what we have right now. So Biden as a president and a Republicans in the House splits the Congress, and we're going to have the good markets there. 13.7% annual return on your investment with a Republican president and a split Congress.
Interesting.
12.9% return if you get a Republican trifecta, and only 9% return if you get a Democratic trifecta. So the answer is, if markets are what you care about the most, what you want is to wander into the ballot this year and vote for Biden as the president and whoever is our Republican nominee for the Senate and whoever is the Republican nominee for the House.
The status quo. And that makes sense. I mean, and if it makes sense in terms of the present time, because the economy is doing really well.
Right. But it's not just about the status quo, because
sure.
This looks at data over 90 years.
No, I understand.
Right, Greg?
I understand.
It's basically going, even if it was a change, when do we get good change? So the years when Obama was president and there's a Democratic Congress, those are bad for markets. 9% return. Unified government causes the most disruptions. So the deal is, if
so surprising.
Why are you surprised by that? If I'm
because
the president,
unified government means the president gets his agenda.
Right. So you get the most disruptions. So I promised all these things in the election. I said, I'm going to do all this stuff. Let's talk about Obama. We'll pick on him. So I'm like, I'm going to change healthcare. I'm going to make it. Everyone's going to have healthcare. I get into office. I have Democrats with me. And so I do the most disruptive policy change to the healthcare industry maybe ever.
Because you're in a position
well,
to
you
do so. Right, right.
So the
I
Affordable
understand.
Care
yep.
Act yep. gets passed. Those kind of major policy changes cause the most disruption to the markets. So if I'm just picking on healthcare, and please note, I'm not making an argument whether we should have policy change.
Right.
I'm just saying the reason why we have the lowest return on investment when there's a Democratic trifecta is Democrats like to do big policy agendas. Republicans or conservatives tend to go a little lighter. Does that make sense? Like they don't do that. But Democrats are all in. They're going to change healthcare. Back in 1993, they're going to change family and medical leave. They're going to make it that everyone gets to go home and take care of stuff. Right? All of those changes make investors nervous. Does that make sense,
yeah,
Greg?
Yeah, I mean, the more you're talking about it, the more it does make sense. Because if one particular party has an agenda and they get all their items through, they're not thinking about the economy. They're thinking about the particular items that are on their agenda. Whereas if you've got a divided Congress, you've got to have the big picture in mind. You've got to be thinking about crossing the aisle, the economy, you've got to have everything in mind. I do understand it the more you're describing this. And so these numbers, I wouldn't have guessed them. I would have guessed just the opposite. But I'm surprised I'm not surprised that that's what we're learning right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that's interesting, too, is generally we have conversations in this country about being divided is a problem, right? And so we... And you hear this on the left when you've got a Democratic president. You hear it on the right when you have a Republican president. It's like, just let me do. Oh, my gosh. I just feel like I'm picking on Obama a lot tonight. And I'm really sorry. But like one of his quotes was, I don't need Congress. I have pen and a phone. Right. Like,
right.
He's like, I will just executive order my way into all the things that I want to do. And the answer actually is the country works the best when we have divided government. because we get better checks and balances. There is incentive in tribalism for me to look at my guy who's on my team and be like, whatever they want, they get. Right. And the whole country is designed with this idea of ambition counteracting ambition, the having people checking each other, which we only get when we have division.
So what do we expect in 2024? I mean, let's start with Congress. Let's talk about the Senate. Let's talk about the president. Where do we expect those? What do you think that the pundits are thinking in November?
The answer is the Senate's going to be Republican because there are more Democratic seats that are being defended. Does that make sense?
Yes, so there's of like course. 33 They've got more to lose.
Yeah, 33 Senates are up.
And they can't lose.
And the place right. where they can't. Right. So we've got so Democrats are defending. And usually when you're defending, you're going to lose. It's a pretty tight Senate.
At least
and
one
so,
or two, right,
right. As a result, pretty much we think the Republicans are going to be in the Senate. So therefore, given what we just said, everyone should vote for Biden. Right. So we assume the Senate's going to be Republican. We need to have a Democratic president.
Right.
I'm not endorsing anything. I'm just saying like if,
no,
if this
what
theory
you're
about markets is right. The thing on the House is tricky. So the answer is right now, if one Republican stayed home tomorrow because they had the flu, Hakeem and Jeffries is in charge, right? So the answer is that narrow margin is so tight.
The Senate's that close too. But it's like you say, more Democrats are up for
election. Defending,
whereas
that's right.
the House, everybody's up.
Everybody's up. So
yeah,
the House, everyone's up all at the same time. The Senate, we've only got a third. So in the Senate, you're looking at a calendar really, the map and really strategically. In the House, it's everybody. And the Republicans, I feel like it's possible they're going to bounce Mike Johnson just for fun this weekend or this summer. Not this weekend, for this summer. And so what's going to happen there is really up for grabs. So House is hard to predict. Pretty sure the Senate's going to be Republican.
And right now we're looking at a market that's doing exceedingly well, which seems to follow this exact model.
Correct.
Which is because we've got a divided Congress,
that's right.
And we've got a president, a Democratic
president. Yeah, and because
president.
The answer
so the markets
basically,
have done
right.
really well.
So the markets basically go, we know we are not going to get any huge change. By the way, the argument might be we shouldn't have huge change. Like maybe governments should
that
calm down a little
market.
Bit. Right.
Yeah, right.
Or no, just upsets anything. Why
right.
do we need to have huge policy change like every year? So the answer is the more stable it is, the more the market can predict it, the more investors feel comfortable. Right, right. So I would argue if Trump is elected president, then markets are going to go kittywampus. And part of that is because President Trump, he's fun. I mean, like he's very exciting. Do you know what I mean? In a political sense, but that's not stable and it's not super exciting for a market. And so the market probably reacts poorly to that.
And you're thinking that if Trump wins, that we have what you've called a Republican trifecta.
Right.
At least... Presumably.
Right. Not as bad as a Democratic trifecta, but not as good as split government.
Right.
So next up on KSL at Night, Greg, I feel like we live in a movie. It could be like Ocean's 15, whatever number we're on for those movies, because we may be seeing the biggest money heist in history. Stay tuned.
KSL at Night.
And you're back with us on KSL at Night alongside Leah Murray. I'm your host, Greg Skordis. And Leah, every once in a while, an event happens and you think, there's going to be a TV movie made out of this someday. And what I'm talking about is, and I hadn't even heard about this until we started prepping the show tonight, but apparently the biggest money heist in Los Angeles history recently happened. It was Easter Sunday, a cash heist that they've decided was probably the biggest in Los Angeles history. Thieves covertly got in through the roof of a building that holds money for an armored truck company. Without setting off any alarms, they got into the vault and left with tens of millions of dollars.
Do you think it was Brad Pitt and George Clooney?
Yeah, I think it was like this Ocean's, what is it?
Ocean's
12
11,
now.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't even discovered until Monday morning. There are currently no suspects, and the sophistication of the operation indicates that the crew had some sort of... that a crew was somehow responsible. It wasn't just a limited group. So the FBI is obviously on the case. We're talking tens of millions of dollars. We don't know a lot about it. But our guest, Alex Stone, ABC News correspondent in Los Angeles, does. Alex, thanks for joining us this evening.
Hey there, guys. Yeah, the FBI, the LAPD, they're trying to answer who did this. How did they do it? We know that they went through the roof, and then they were able to, it's a nondescript building in the Sylmar area of L.A., you drive by it, it just looks like any office building. Somebody had to know what was in the building, how to get in the building, bypass high-tech security, go. They went through the roof and then got their way into the vault. And then they got into the vault and they had access to the money, but they never set off any of the alarms. And nobody had any idea. And then they were able just to take their way out of there with $30 million in cash. You can imagine how much that weighed, hundreds of pounds. And they are gone. And they're in the wind. And the FBI says it's investigating. Our sources are telling us they have no suspects right now. They don't know who did this. Whoever did do it, highly sophisticated. Wouldn't be surprised if there was some inside info that helped them do this to be able to get around all the security. But they clearly knew what was in there, and a lot of work went into it.
So, Alex, I feel like if it were in Vegas, like the Ocean's 11's movies, right? Like, it makes sense to me because a casino would have so much money on hand. What building holds this kind of money that's just sitting there? Does that make sense? And, like, you know, just, I don't know. I'm feeling like if
yeah,
I were
so
going...
It's an armored car company, Garda World. You've probably seen their armored cars driving around. And so they handle cash for businesses. And they, as part of that, they've got vault services where, you know, they tell a business, we'll take your cash off-site, let's say a restaurant, so that they don't have a lot of cash on-site, and they'll go and put it in their vault and store it there. And then, you know, whatever is going to go on, deposit it, count it, they handle all of that. So it's kind of where all of the armored cars go and drop off what they're picking up. If they're not bringing it to a bank, they bring it there for, you know, safekeeping. Typically, not right now, but safekeeping, and keep it in the vault until the next step. So they had a lot of money in there. But again, you would not have known that unless you knew what was in the building, because totally nondescript, and you wouldn't know that there was a vault with $30 million in there.
Right, yeah, that's totally... So what I like what you're just saying, it's not like it's people's money, right? So it's not a bank, it's not that, you know, someone won't be able to write a check off their personal account. It basically is a holding place, right? Man, so Alex, I know you can't, like, speculate, but I'm going to ask you to anyway. Does it feel like someone knew that some restaurant, do you know what I mean, had, like, unloaded a lot of money? Like, maybe they'd had a really good Easter weekend or something? Like, is that what we're thinking might be the thing?
Well, it seems like there's always a lot of money in there.
Okay.
The general public probably didn't know it, but they moving around money, and that this was a vault where they kept a lot of that as they were moving it around. So probably not more unusual than any other weekend. But it's just that the bad guys were able to get in there. You know, it reminds us a lot of 2 years ago, there was a armored big rig from Brinks, different company. This one was Garda, that one was Brinks, in the mountains north of L.A., where they pulled over at a rest stop. It was an 18-wheeler. Yeah, you know, you probably wouldn't know that there are armored 18-wheelers. Looks like any other 18-wheeler out there. One of the workers was napping in the truck. The other one ran in to go to the bathroom or to get a cup of coffee. They came back and they had been burglarized as well. $100 million in jewels gone that they were transporting from the San Francisco Bay Area down to the LA area for an expo. And there's some debate about the price tag on those. As the insurance companies say no, more like $10 million. The owners of the jewels say $100 million. But this whole thing went down and they had no idea that they had been burglarized, that anybody had gotten in their truck. Same sort of thing, and that not these two are not connected, but still, that it was believed that was a crew who knew what was in that unmarked truck that was able to act without anybody noticing, without anybody around the truck noticing that they were getting into it, that they were breaking locks and getting in and cutting locks, without the guy sleeping in the cab noticing, without, I mean, the one who ran in to go to the bathroom was only gone for a couple of minutes, and they were able to do it then and steal $100 million in jewels.
And Alex, I'm looking at some of the reports about this. These thieves enter the building without setting alarms. They go through the roof. But once they get in there, the money's in a vault. And to me, I'm thinking of a vault as like a safe. It's not something you just open the door of. I mean, I don't know whether you know the details of the vault, but I assume that once you get in the building, you still got to get in the little box that holds $30 million, which has got to be the size of a garage.
Yeah, and we don't know a lot of the details because Garda is not even confirming that this has gone on, that they are not responding to anybody. They are not admitting that this has happened, so at least publicly. So the details of what the inside of the building is like, we understand highly secure, very high tech, that sure, the vault inside there through technology, you know, whether it be fingerprints or passcodes or matching up numbers or whatever it is, that something is very high tech in there, but the exact details of that vault, we just don't know.
So, Alex, I'm just going to go back to the story you told about the truck and all the jewels. Did they ever recover that money or those jewels?
No, it's still totally on the run. That they don't know who did it. That was 2 years ago. They don't know where the jewels went. They disappeared in the wind, a lot like this cash did, just poof, gone.
Yeah, so Alex, and how do we know they're not connected? I mean, I guess I feel like, if I were paying attention.
I mean, they might be, but at this point, investigators are telling us they have nothing indicating that these two are connected.
Gotcha.
There was a burglary somewhat similar to the Sunday's burglary in 1997. $18 million was taken in L.A. of an armored car company. This one may or may not end up being bigger than that one. That one in 97 was solved, and they got the guys behind that one. There were a number. There was a crew working in the 90s in L.A. doing a lot of these kinds of things, going through the roof. I mean, the MO looks very similar. They don't think, I mean, most of those guys now would be quite old if they were doing it in the 90s. They don't think that this is connected to them either. But this is not a first in L.A., but this one definitely making headlines because it's so much money.
And, you know, the problem with stealing cash, Alex, is that it's not necessarily traceable. It's not like you get money that's got everybody records the number, so they could be passing this money now. Maybe they are, and no one would
have
no
idea. I was told some of the serial numbers they may know, but still, when you're using cash, is anybody ever looking at the serial numbers or noticing, unless, you know, some crazy thing like they're buying an airplane with cash? That you would, even if Garda has the serial numbers, what would that mean? Probably nothing.
Fascinating. Alex, thanks for joining us. And we may have you back in a few days when we have more information about this. But thank you so much.
You got it. Sounds good. Thanks, guys.
Thanks so much for being with us tonight. Remember, if you want to revisit any of the things we talked about, go to KSLpodcast.com. After our show's been aired, just look up KSL at Night and really any app that you use to get podcasts, and you can listen to any show. We will see you. Greg and I will be back tomorrow evening. Have a good night.